what do you think agriculture in Africa has been so far?
Well, basically, in the last 30 years, 25 years, agriculture in Africa has received what I will describe as a disinvestment, similar to the way the international community disinvested in agriculture. Because of the food crisis in 2007-2008, there is now a refocusing on agriculture. When governments were investing, in some cases, less than 4% of their budgets into agriculture, you just cannot expect a sector that provides the food for the for the populations to be able to thrive. Governments, as well as the development community, today recognize that agriculture is the engine for economic growth, and that we must invest in agriculture on a sustainable basis.
Well, Dr. Nwanze, many African heads of states and countries have usually said that agriculture is the engine of growth, but nothing substantial happens. It seems to be just talk shops. They make all these nice, you know, promises and rhetorics, and nothing happens. Why do you think this has been so?
Well, you're right. You're right. But let's look at it from various angles. Prior to the 80s, agriculture provided 60 to 80% of the GDP of most African countries. You know it yourself. It was very viable, good export earnings, good income. But as I said, you know, they disinvested and they went into infrastructure development. And in some cases, they were ill-advised by institutions like the World Bank, and we've had structural adjustments. And 25 years later, the consequences are what we experienced. Having said that, at the same time, they have competing demands on their budgetary requirements. And, you know, many countries had difficulties, you know, meeting the various demands on education, on health, infrastructure, roads, you name it. But then we must also give credit to the African leaders, because in 2003, they determined and they agreed and they declared to devote 10% of their budgets to agriculture. Well, you say, well, it's lip service. They said they would. Some countries are doing very good. 8 or 9 countries have achieved 10%, more than 10% of their budgets into agriculture. Tanzania, Malawi, Senegal, Mali, Kenya, Ghana, your country, where you were born, are doing very well. Another 10 or 15 are between 5 and 10%. So there is recognition of the need to begin to reinvest on a sustainable basis to agriculture. It has to be sustained.
When you look at African countries, take West Africa, for example, there's land, there's rain, good soil. You go to East Africa, you go to Central Africa, it's all there. Why do you think successive governments have so far not been able to push agriculture forward, especially when their citizens are faced with a lot of hunger that causes strife and exacerbates a lot of problems across the continent?
Bad policies, bad advice, investment in the wrong sectors, and because they did not see agriculture as the engine of economic growth. We have to keep on repeating this to our leaders. You know, when you take successful stories like China, Brazil, Vietnam, India, you name it, they have been able to transform their economies because they invested in agriculture in the rural sector, and they invested in smallholder agricultures. In Africa, 80 to 90% of all farms are smallholder, if not even 95%. And if you really want to increase and sustain your production and productivity, you must invest in farming. And we have to change our mindsets. It's a whole paradigm shift that farming is a business. It's not just a handout. It's not just a poor man's occupation. Farming is a business, and every business, to succeed, you must invest in it. You must create opportunities for these farmers to be able to be linked to markets. You must give them opportunities, financial services. You must give them the right institutions to support their organizations. You must give them infrastructure, roads, to be able to transport their produce. You know, all of this is what, you know, requires sustained effort by government. And to realize that without your ability to feed yourself, you'll be dependent on external assistance, external aid. It is beginning to change, and this is the message that I keep giving to our governments, that agriculture is the engine for economic growth. It has been shown through centuries, from England to Europe to China to Vietnam of today. Some countries are listening. A good case, as I said, is Tanzania. President Kikwete is doing a fantastic job. And so also in Ghana, in Malawi, have fantastic success stories coming out of Malawi. You know, Malawi in 2004 was a net importer of maize. By 2006, they were exporting maize to their neighboring countries because they invested in a very smart fertilizer subsidy program. Well, it works. It can work.
Well, Dr. Mwanze, you said that there should be a paradigm shift. Apart from the three countries that you mentioned, so far other countries seem to be doing quite well. I mean, Sudan, for example, apart from the oil, will be faced with a lot of food crisis. Niger in West Africa is having similar problems. In your capacity, how are you helping these heads of states or countries, advising them, you know, to take these proper steps to address the food crisis in their country, especially to look at it from a business perspective?
Yeah, you know, one thing I like also to throw into this discussion is that I don't need to convince the agricultural minister of the need for him to invest in agriculture. I need to be able to convince the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Economic Planning that they should put money into agriculture. I need to support the Minister of Agriculture in arguing his case. But as I said, the demands are many. You have a budget. I mean, how many countries are able to foot their own budget? Many of them, they get budget support from the development partners, you know. But as I said, gradually they are. Well, there are cases where it's just terrible, bad governance. You know, the country where I was born, you know, has no reason to be getting assistance for food production. Because prior to the discovery of oil in Nigeria, we had histories of granite pyramids and timber exports and what have you, cocoa production in Ghana, in Côte d'Ivoire, in Ivory Coast. But these governments, you know, all of a sudden, oil came into Nigeria, and agriculture, which used to be about 60 to 70% of its GDP, dropped to about 20%. And we have the consequences of very poor governance and bad management of our resources. It cannot continue forever. That is obviously the case. You know what happened in 2007, 2008 with the food riots. It brought down a couple of governments in Haiti and in Madagascar subsequently. So, as I said, the African Union today is putting together efforts to help the regional economic communities to get their house together. And this is the message I give to our leaders. Get your house together, put your money where your mouth is. And when you set the right policies to support smallholder farmers that produce the majority of the food that is consumed, and in particular, we should not forget women farmers, because they do the majority of the work. Investing in women, investing in youth, investing in girls and young women is all key. They do 60 to 80% of all the processes that we talk about in agriculture. So getting this message back, you see, in the past, people did not talk about these things the way I talk about it. I can talk about it. I can talk to the heads of states of government. I can tell them the way it is. And we have to continue to push for it. We've got to continue to get support. And we've got to continue to explain to them that the only way to get out of poverty is to invest in agriculture, invest in rural development.
You talked about the women and children playing a pivotal role in the subsistence kind of farming in across Africa. Now, thinking about having a commercialized sense that will feed more people, that could lead to export, bring in foreign exchange to develop their areas, hasn't been government priorities across the continent, although I've spoken to several heads of state, ministers, cabinet ministers. They seem to have the idea that this is the way to go. But the will seem not to be there.
Yeah, but you see, let's look at it from a different perspective. I think too many a time when we talk about commercialization of agriculture, we look at large-scale enterprises. You know, in Africa, 90% of all farms, in some cases 95% of all farms, are less than 1.5 hectare. And the majority are less than 1 hectare. When we talk about commercialization of agriculture, commercialization of smallholder agriculture, you're talking about transforming the farmer from just subsistence to producing more. You've got to give him access to inputs, to fertilizer, to small irrigation systems, to better seeds, and encourage him to increase his production and his productivity levels so he can sell more. But then you have to create access to local competitive markets. We should stop thinking of international markets as the only markets that exist. Give small farmers the opportunity to have access to their small local markets. And that is what is important. So the right policies must be there. When they see how much they can make out of being able to sell in their local markets, I bet you they will invest in their business. This is the difference. So we're saying, create the opportunities, give them support, give them access to microfinance, rural financing, so women can be able to take small loans to be able to increase their production and to be able to access and sell in their local markets. When they can realize the benefits, they will invest and increase the quality of their produce. When they have started to produce surpluses, they will begin to transform it and add value to the produce, and they begin to produce local, transformed, value-added products. That is the way the world changed. That is the way China went. Today, Vietnam is doing exactly the same thing. In 1980, Vietnam was importing rice. It was food deficit in rice. Today, Vietnam is the second largest exporter of rice. 60 to 70% of the rice is produced by small farmers, organizing themselves into associations. That is what it takes. And there is no reason why the same thing couldn't happen in Africa. Africa cannot leapfrog into the 21st century if it does not invest in its natural resources and its agricultural sector.
How closely are you working with the African Union, especially when they have the Forum of Heads of States and Government, so some of these ideas that you are enumerating would transcend, passed on to them, and then they can implement such pragmatic policies in their countries?
I'll give you an example. My institution, IFAD, worked with the African Union, with the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, and with NEPAD to develop land policies for which was adopted by the African Union. We're working with them also in the remittances and in the rural finance facility that we also host. We participate in their policy advisory groups and in their annual sessions. But I think what's important is that also right now what is happening in Africa with this new agricultural fund that has been hosted by the World Bank is to get the African countries to develop through the NEPAD process. We have been able to develop what is called CADEP Compacts. That's the Comprehensive African Agricultural Development Program, where countries are developing their compacts, their strategies for increased food production and food security, which will make them able to have access to these new funds. And this is all part of, you know, what we're doing with the World Bank, with the FAO, and the African countries. So it's a very close relationship, but also working with the regional economic communities like ECOWAS in West Africa and COMESA in Southern Africa and all the others.
You said Africa has the potential to feed itself as long as the smallholder farmers are supported with access to market routes, storage. Those things will allow them to turn a profit. Will you be pushing these governments to follow such policies?
I have been pushing this, and IFAD has been working exactly along those lines for the last 33 years. It's our mission, and we believe it works, and we have good examples in many parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. I've seen success stories in Mali a few weeks ago, in northern Mali, a project working with women entrepreneurs. We have programs in West Africa with the cassava program, which we've funded for the last 10 years, transforming cassava produce to starch, to enzymes, and what have you, and creating opportunities. There's no reason why Africa cannot feed itself. When you look at a continent that has all this land that's available, uses only about 8 kilograms of fertilizer per hectare compared to 120 kg in Asia or 200 kg, for instance, in China. Only about 5% of its arable land is irrigated. 5%, and most of it is in Egypt. So we have not even exploited our irrigation systems, obviously. A continent that has such a range of agroecologies can produce enough food to feed itself or produce enough food to make money to buy what it doesn't produce. But it takes leadership. Leadership that is dedicated and committed to bringing their people out of poverty. You cannot ignore 400,000 smallholders that produce the majority of the food that is consumed worldwide. And in Africa, we're looking at about half of the population of Africa, smallholder farmers that have the potential. They are not stupid. They want to make money. They want to be able to send their children to school and to send them to clinics when they are sick. But you've got to invest in the rural sector because that is where the potential is. Farms do not grow in cities. Farms grow in rural areas. That's why you must invest in agriculture and rural development. It is a very simple message.
Do you think land disputes should be resolved in order for some of these pragmatic policies that you're enumerating could bear fruit?
Yeah, we are working with a lot of governments in Africa. We're working with a lot of governments in Asia and Latin America, putting together land policies, land titling, communal land rights, and the rest of it. It's a long process, but we are making progress in many countries. And essentially, most of the time, it is women that are disadvantaged. They cannot own land. Or if they have lands with their husband, when the husband passes away, the land is no longer theirs. And we're making some progress in some countries, working, creating situations where they are entitled to their land, they have land titling, and it's respected by government and by communities. Gradually, it is taking on shape, not only in Africa, in Asia and Latin America, but it is a major. You see, because if it's not your property, why would you want to invest? So it's a disincentive. So if you want an incentive, you must give them the possibility of owning the land so that they can invest. And so this is all part of what we talk about, the policy dialogue. You know, inputs into the land. If you want me to buy fertilizers and to improve the health of the soil, if it's not mine, why should I invest in it? So it's all part of it. Land titling is a key element in agricultural development.
In the 1950s and 60s and early 70s, you had countries like Cote d'Ivoire under the leadership of President Hofo Boigny. You had Kwame Nkrumah. Of course, when you go to Southern Africa, you had Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. They led an agricultural-based economy where the food production was at the epicenter of the... they had state farms where even prisoners were involved in farming. What happened?
Well, that was what, you see, you're talking about the visionary leaders, you know, that saw the role of agriculture, whether they were called state farms or whatever. They were visionary leaders, they saw the role of agriculture. But, you see, at that time, they did not know that their countries had oil and gas, you see. So I told you the case of Nigeria. It's the same thing. It's happened in many other countries. You mentioned Cote d'Ivoire. But I think now that people are beginning to realize that you cannot depend on oil alone to feed your people. You've got to be able to produce, because see, food is also a political instrument. If you're not able to produce your own food and you're expecting somebody else to produce and sell to you, you are very vulnerable. So one aspect in this whole debate, the discussion, is the realization that the ability to produce food to feed your own people is so central to your own development. Any nation, any leader that cannot feed his people and depends on foreign assistance to feed his people is making the greatest mistake of his leadership.
What is your take on food production and meeting the Millennium Challenge goals?
The Millennium Development Goals. I think if you take China away from the equation, many countries in the world will not be able to meet the Millennium Development Goal number one, which is to have the number of people that go hungry by 2015. we would not meet it, because there are additional challenges today to that equation. Climate change is going to be a major mitigating factor that will make it difficult. Weather patterns are unpredictable. All you need to do is to look into the papers and the news, and you find the droughts and floods here and there. So climate change is going to be a major challenge. And the financial situation, the economic financial crisis, is going to make it difficult. So there are additional aspects to the challenge of meeting the MDGs. However, as I said, there are countries in Africa that are beginning to move towards that direction, because they realize the need for them to invest in agriculture. But many countries will not be able to meet those challenges. Not only MDG 1, in many other sectors, health, maternal and child health, education, gender equality, you name it, partnerships, private sector engagement. It's not going to be, because they're all interlinked. There's an interconnectedness in all of this. And let's take the example of MDG 1. If you invest in agriculture and food production, and people eat well and better, you are addressing health. You are addressing education, because when children have food in their stomachs, they go to school, and when they go to school, they can study. You have gender equality, because then you can create opportunities for young girls and women to compete. So I believe that they're all interconnectedness, and we should not compartmentalize the MDGs as if they are separate entities. The whole development process brings all of them so that they converge, and they are an essential element in their connectedness to be able to bring people out of poverty and to increase the economic wealth of countries.
An angry man is a hungry man. Well, let's look at the World Economic Forum meeting on Africa in Tanzania from the 5th of May to the 7th of May, which will focus on the Rethinking Africa's Growth Strategy with a particular focus on agriculture. What do you see in this?
Well, fortunately, I have been invited by President Kikwete to the African Regional World Economic Forum, and there we'll be looking at redesigning Africa's agricultural development. I think this is a very welcome development, because the fact that for the first time the region of Eastern Africa will be hosting the WEF, and that there's a focus on agriculture, African agriculture, already tells you that people are beginning to see the importance, the pivotal role, the central role of agriculture in the economic development. It's a unique opportunity for us to begin to partner with the private sector. See, the private sector has been excluded in this equation, and that has been an error all these years. I think we have to partner with the private sector. We have to encourage public-private partnerships, because the private sector is an essential partner in bringing about this transformation. I also see the role of civil society in these discussions. But more importantly, I hope that in Dar es Salaam, we'll be able again to shout our message to the world. That when you talk about agriculture and food production, please remember that the population that is producing the food that you eat in the urban areas live in rural areas, and they are smallholder farmers. And we also want to bring focus to Africa, to that part of Africa, Tanzania, that is making good progress in transforming the country, both in terms of its governance, in terms of institutions, and in terms of agriculture.
With a new wave of agriculture blowing across Africa, how would IFAD's objective be achieved?
It becomes for us even more increasingly challenging, because it puts us right in center stage. For the last 33 years, our business has been very straightforward. Poverty eradication, enabling poor people in rural areas to overcome poverty, focusing on agriculture and rural development. That's our mission. And with the increasing demand for food, if we have to double food production by 2050 to be able to feed an increase of 50% of the world's population, the only way we can do it is to increase the production and productivity of agriculture, and to make smallholder farmers part of the solution. And that is where IFAD's ability to leverage additional financing through partnerships, that is where our ability to upscale innovations that make it possible for agriculture to be able to achieve its full potential becomes even more challenging. But I believe that my institution is right at the center stage because of what it's been doing. It has a track record of working with governments through community development projects and getting the grassroots information into this whole exercise, that we are looking at a very exciting period. Unfortunately, the food crisis brought the awareness of governments to the need to focus on agriculture. You needed the crisis to bring that up. But fortunately, they are listening, and I hope they'll be listening for a long time to come, because agriculture, food production, is not something you turn on and off like a tap. It has to be sustained over a long term.
Well, if I be putting structures in place in order to monitor the progress of these governments as they enter, they focus more on agriculture and feeding their own people.
Yeah, we'll be working with, because in what I spoke about earlier on, in this global agriculture food security program, and in the we didn't talk about this initially, you know, the commitments that were made by the G8 in L'Aquila in Rome, and then subsequently in Pittsburgh by the G20 to allocate 22 billion to agriculture. Both the Canadians now, the US and Spain, and now Korea that are beginning to put some funds to this, really want to put together a monitoring process to see, one, in terms of whether donors' commitments have been met, but also, two, in terms of countries that benefit from these new investments actually deliver results on the ground. And so you're going to have a two-way accountability. You promised some money, you created hope, you must deliver. You ask for additional resources, you're committed to deliver, and we must. So you're going to have a monitoring system whereby to ensure that donors or development partners meet their commitments and recipient countries deliver on their promises.
Dr. Wanze, what is your final message to African heads of states and government ahead of this World Economic Forum on Africa?
My message is very simple. Meetings, declarations do not feed hungry people. Only action on the ground. They must put their they must invest the political capital and political will to put agriculture as a priority of priorities, and to ensure that they invest, no matter how small, the financial requirements to boost agricultural production and be able to absorb additional support from the international community.